for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Bressel in Carmel, California. This is radio broadcast number 467, November the 16th, 1980. It will be 17 years this week since John Kennedy was assassinated, November 22nd, 1963. There's a whole new generation of young people growing up who barely remember the incident at all and have been brought up in the school system to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. There is a lot of discrepancy on that conclusion, the official government conclusion, but the news media continues to perpetuate the story, for the most part, that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. As many of you know, I began my research in that time period, 2 days after Kennedy was assassinated, when Jack Ruby stepped up and shot a man named Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail, if that was Oswald and not a double. We had never seen Oswald before, so we were told that was Lee Harvey Oswald, and there are even discrepancies in those conclusions through the past 17 years that continue to this day. We've seen a lot of murders since Kennedy was killed, political assassinations, a lot of mediocrity in the White House, a lot of media silence, and now we end up with the moral majority. It's pretty sickening to study this thing for 17 years and see the progression of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon and then Gerald Ford and now Ronald Reagan in the White House, Jimmy Carter as an interim president because Reagan was selected a long time ago, and the full assassination team is in power now as they were as soon as Kennedy was killed, and have control of all the major agencies which they usurped at that time and took for themselves to control us or the world in any way that they wanted. There was a conference this last week in Los Angeles of scholars and people from the New Frontier. 40 members of the New Frontier gathered for a two-day conference at the University of Southern California to examine John Kennedy's social, foreign affairs, civil rights, and military programs. And it was the first time they had been there to discuss the policies of John Kennedy that were made 20 years ago and came to the conclusion that he was the last U.S. chief with a vision of the future. Several people spoke there. Roger Hilsman was former director of the State Department, Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and people from the Pentagon, arms control agencies, disarmament agencies, and so forth were there lecturing. It's a shame that they've been quiet for 17 years about who killed John Kennedy, and they can look at him posthumously while the effect of that murder still reaches all of us. He was the last U.S. chief with a vision, and these men are too short-sighted to continue that vision and make a future for us, reverse the trend of mediocrity and thievery and murder from the White House on down. These people don't have the courage to do anything but study it academically and not get into the hard evidence, even the recent House Select Committee on Assassinations or the question of whether Lee Harvey Oswald is even in that grave in Texas, the problem of exhuming that body. It's really a tragedy that these scholars on the John Kennedy era don't have the guts to find out why the dreams and visions and the programs ended on November 22nd, 1963. I'm studying the new Reagan cabinet, the cronies he's had. I've had many, many files on Ronald Reagan through these years in public office as governor, aspiring to become president of the United States, and it requires a tremendous amount of research. And of course, now that he's choosing a cabinet, I have to go through all the articles that come out that are pertinent to various subjects on Ronald Reagan and study those carefully and learn a whole new team of men, their backgrounds. And even though we've seen them before, such as Mr. Casey with his employment by Robert Besco and his role as the Security Exchange Commission at the time of Watergate, and we've heard many of the names through the Watergate era, we must redefine them and where they've been since Nixon was kicked out of office, where they've been in the past years in intelligence operations and what is going to be their role in the future. I'm studying the various people working with Ronald Reagan that are prominent in the news that were part of the Kennedy assassination team, such as Gerald Ford and John Connolly. I study the big changes that are happening through the administration. I'll read off some of those, that just items in the news in the past week that are enough to scare any of us in intent of changing occupational safety rules or rules for the industry, factory owners to take away benefits for workers and lower wages and so forth, the clean air bills to be negated and tested for a year, no regulations of any kind for health, safety, and otherwise. I have a large category on George Bush and the CIA, the CIA appointments for his cabinet that he's making now, people that worked in the CIA with him, so that if anything happens to Ronald Reagan, the entire cabinet of George Bush would be CIA. And then we have to learn the new names of the Reagan cabinet, even though they were with him in the past or in California, they move into Washington. And these names will become familiar, some of them from Watergate, like General Haig and Richard Allen and Mr. Casey. And there are many, many others. I have brought some files here, Mr. Weinberger, Caspar Weinberger, and I can run down some of those names for you. I have a section on the church and what they expect from Ronald Reagan. He came in saying he owed the election to no particular group, but the moral majority and the far right are very vocal, and they're very displeased with his appointments because so far they come from the Ford-Nixon administration and the likes of Henry Kissinger and George Shultz are much too liberal. And the far right wing, I guess as far right as Adolf Hitler, feel that he's selling them out, and they've said quite clearly in the newspaper they are very displeased. And then we'll watch the role of Ronald Reagan, not only with the church, but with the new pope. Those of you who have my tapes a while back when John Paul II became the pope, remember the research that I did and the conclusion based on the research that John Paul II worked at Auschwitz during the concentration camp period. Worked for IG Farben, the company that made the chemical that was doing the exterminations. And now the Pope was in Germany just this week asking for the two Germanys to be united. And he also works with the labor leaders in Poland. There's an article of his interference in the labor strikes. He is not a Pope that simply tends to the religion of the Catholics, but he's one of the most political popes since the popes at the time of Nazi Germany and during the Spanish Civil War. I'm studying the people in Congress that were removed, and of course the new committees that are taking over and the power they'll have and their links to past political assassinations. And there are many articles in the newspaper on the effect of Ronald Reagan's administration on South Africa, on Argentina. He doesn't believe in interfering with civil rights or the human rights, and those governments should be allowed to do what they want. There's another group in addition to the church, the Heritage Foundation, and Richard Vogery, the far right. Again, Vogery was an instrument of Young Americans for Freedom in the Southwest, and he moved to Washington to cling out the congressmen that they have targeted, to get rid of them systematically until they get the kind of Congress that elected Adolf Hitler in 1933. The far right is very active, they're very vocal, they're well organized, and they're funded with as much money as they could possibly have. And then, of course, we have to watch the excuse of terrorism to take over the FBI and the CIA. There were articles just today in the Sunday paper, many of you probably saw it, that in Ronald Reagan's administration, the FBI should again be allowed to do black bags, burglary, open the mail, doesn't have to have permission of the president or the attorney general. They can have illegal entry and clandestine activities, that they should unleash the CIA and turn us back to the Nixon era or the LBJ era and get us back to the time where we had absolutely no privacy and we were photographed and so forth. That will happen to the intelligence community. Also, the control of the media is going to escalate. Claire Luce is giving lectures at the colleges. She's the widow of Henry Luce of Time, Life, and Fortune, crying about the prosecution of two FBI agents for illegal entry and making heroes out of them. Claire Luce is a very active media person, and Radio Free Europe and the large towers from the Christian Council, the Vatican Radio Tower, which is the most powerful in the world, will begin increasing beaming anti-communist radio talks over the radio. And the think tanks are another section that I've separated. I've talked briefly on this program about the Hoover Institute, and I'll bring up some information about the George Washington University and the effect it's going to have on the Reagan administration. Right now, they're glad to have very few people from Harvard. The think tanks will supply, as they have supplied the speeches for Ronald Reagan, they'll supply the actions and the thinkers, and I'm going into one of those particular ones in a few minutes. And then, of course, there's the transition team, and I will be doing from time to time broadcasts and biographies of people helping him with the transition team, always keeping in mind their links to the past political murders and assassinations that made it possible for Ronald Reagan to be president in 1980. One example of an advisor for the transition team is Ebel Younger, the former Attorney General of California, who was the key man in the interstate national link from the Los Angeles Police Department up through California to Washington, what Lewis Tackwood called the Gestapo, that Chief of Police Ed Davis wanted, and Ebel Younger. Ebel Younger is now advising Ronald Reagan on justice and security. I believe that someday he will be suggested either as a justice of the Supreme Court or the acting the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He was the district attorney in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was killed at the Ambassador Hotel. He said that he'd leave no stone unturned on the story of Sirhan. The trial involved hypnotizing Sirhan and telling him how he killed Robert Kennedy. Dr. Diamond did that, where the actual fatal bullets came from Thane Caesar standing in back of Robert Kennedy, and Sirhan didn't fire the fatal bullets into Robert Kennedy at all. Ebel Younger was not interested in pursuing the investigation. He covered it up. As he, I say, he went on to be the Attorney General of California from the DA in Los Angeles. He has a long list of military credentials. He's on the reserve. He's high up in the United States military and the FBI and the intelligence community. And Ed Davis, his cohort of the LAPD, who was there through all of the violence and COINTEL programs going on through the entire state of California, is now a senator in California. Another area that I'll be watching, in addition to the people who involved in the assassination teams, are the Watergate people, because they overlap and are part of the assassination teams. G. Gordon Liddy has become a college hero. He's been written up in all the newspapers lately. He's a smart aleck guy who tells how he would kill his own son and brags about his ability to kill and his willingness to kill. And all of a sudden, this Watergate person is surfacing as a very camp college leader, going around at $3,000 a lecture with hundreds of lectures in advance, making a fortune and becoming a folk hero in that he's willing to die or kill to stop what he calls communism. And, of course, it was Gerald Ford from the Warren Commission, appointed by Richard Nixon to investigate the murder of John Kennedy, who brought G. Gordon Liddy to Washington, D.C., to the Treasury Department at a time when the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms had assassination teams set up within that office. G. Gordon Liddy was an FBI man from New York, Westchester, New York, and I believe it was, who came to Washington, the Treasury Department, and fit right in with E. Howard Hunt and the CIA teams, the group that were involved in the murder of John Kennedy, incorporated Liddy into future assassination teams. And as I say, he's very open about his willingness to die, and the new young generation think he's just groovy. He's a hero because he went to jail, kept his mouth shut, and he's willing to kill and die as a symbol of what he believes in. Now, whether you're right, left, or middle, no matter what your political party is, I repeat again that this new moral majority, this new far right, this new G. Gordon Liddy, they may have the mentality of Adolf Hitler, but they have the genius to strike at the nerve of people who want something to believe in. They want anything. Howdy Doody is gone a long time ago. Captain Kangaroo isn't doing it. The space shows won't do it. Television isn't going to supply the heroes the people need, and they'll latch on to anything if there is no substitute. And there are no believable people in society out there trying to make it better that are visual, that are invited to the campuses to inspire other people to something better than killing and assassinations. And being as there's a vacuum and there's only G. Gordon Liddy, they go to hear him and they're eating it up. They love it. There's an article in newspaper today and several papers that I get on Sunday about a woman, a writer, a journalist, reminded me a little bit above myself, although I have never had the experiences she's had. She wrote a book called A Man, published by Simon & Schuster, and her name is Oriana Fallaci, F-A-L-L-A-C-I. And the man she wrote her book about is Alexander Panagoulis, P-A-N-A-G-O-U-L-I-S. She's Italian, she's a journalist, and she has a large home in Italy and one in France, an apartment in New York. But according to these articles, she locked herself into a room no larger than a prison cell where she stayed for 3 years to write about her friend Alexander. She met him in Greece. He was murdered by the Greek military junta. He had gone to jail for charges of trying to kill the leader of the Greek military regime that was put into power by our CIA in 1967. And when he got out of jail, he was in a car accident that she said was murder. And she described his life under the Nazi dictatorship. She said, "I have never lived under Nazi dictatorship or the Greek military junta," but she got to know him after he was released from jail. She was doing a story about him, and she began to understand what he had endured in the way of torture and in prison in Greece. Now, the CIA had used our Office of Management Budget and Roy Ash of Litton Industries as a cover for the Greek military junta in 67, and that was the first time that Nazis were put back into power in Greece since World War II. A few years later, 6 or 7 years later, the junta was overthrown, but it's still a very traditional government over there now. Now, she has been alerting the readers, according to the book review, story of her book, to authoritarian people around the world. And she felt that Alexander was her boyfriend, that she fell in love with him and was going to marry him, was a Greek poet. But he not only wrote poetry, he was part of the resistance against the Greeks. And I forewarn you now that no matter what your profession is, whoever is listening to me now, there's going to be a time where you're going to have to either give in or form a resistance to what is going to come down under the Reagan administration. And she points out that even though he was a poet, he decided to make some attempt to express his anger, and he was charged with trying to assassinate George Papadopoulos, the military strongman in Greece. They released him in 1973, arranged an accident. She said he was run down by a Greek Nazi because he knew too much. And this person went on to become very wealthy and got promotions and so forth. Her uncle, it was a journalist, and encouraged her to write, this Fallaci. And she said that when she started writing, she felt she had an obligation not to swallow whole what people in power told her, that she became curious and traveled around and decided to be outspoken against what she considered injustice. And I suppose when I started my research 17 years ago, this coming 22nd of November, which is just 6 days away, I made up my mind that I would not swallow what people in power told me and that I would try to find out if there was an injustice in this case, if Lee Harvey Oswald was framed and did in fact kill the president, or if somebody else did it who is out there free enjoying the fruits and getting promoted from this terrible murder. Now, she has gone on to say, "I'm not a diplomat, I'm not a coward, and I'm not a hypocrite," but she accuses the left, the right, and center, and says, she said, "You all murdered him." And I don't belong to any party, she mentioned, a university lecturer at Yale University, I'm not a political person, but when the time comes for struggle, you militants are going to sit at a desk and there are others who are going to struggle and die. She as much as said, get off your ass. Somebody asked about the murder of Allende in Chile, and she said to the Yale students, you can sit around and talk about it, but there's others who struggle and die. And then she said that she has interviewed people like Khomeini and Henry Kissinger and heads of states. She said, I have met the movers and shakers of the world, the bastards who decide our lives. And she was very pessimistic, according to this one book review or two of them, about Western humanity. She feels it's sinking like the Roman Empire, that it hasn't much future. She said, the license and abuse of freedom is a terrible aspect, it's a trouble aspect of America and Europe today. The West is eroded by passivity induced by television, decline in literacy, corruption of technology, and the breakdown of civility and humanism. And she summed up her relationship to many world leaders in three words, in quotes, barbarians, barbarians, barbarians. And she also said, I am not a coward, I shall never be. Her book is a bestseller in Italy. She didn't believe that it would be on the newsstands in Greece more than 48 hours. But this is a woman who covered the war stories in Vietnam, who knew a person who was tortured and confined for what he believed in Greece. He was able to get out of jail and was run down by a man that was a known Nazi. And she's written a book, A Man, and she said she wrote it because she wanted you to know the name Alexander Panagoulis, that there are no heroes, there are no people to look up to, and this is a man who lived and wrote and tried, and he was murdered, and his message and her message should live on. I think of that conference at University of Southern California of the people from the frontier, the great frontier, and the new frontier of John Kennedy assembling down there and talking about his goals and aims, but sitting comfortable in their chairs, no doubt an air-conditioned conference room for 2 days to talk about John Kennedy, but not one single one of those cowards would roll up their sleeves and spend 1 hour to try and find out who killed him. I'm sure they get tax deductions for the conference, but they don't want to know who killed their fallen leader. I mentioned last week the funding of the far right, because the Nazi movement and the far right has endless money for going around publishing literature, weapons, killing, and looting. And it takes a lot of hidden money because the budget of the CIA would be exposed, even though they have billions of dollars that aren't accounted for. Somebody might spill the beans, so that the illegal money, the passing of weapons, goes through all kinds of surreptitious activities. And I mentioned several weeks ago that Nugent Hand Bank in Australia, where $50 million is missing and is involved in the Central Intelligence Agency and the Paisley murder, John Paisley murder, and the Russian department, the area that Lee Harvey Oswald worked with. Along those lines, there was another article this week about a Paris thief, a set of thieves that got $12 million. Now, this last week, November the 4th, there was an article, Weekend Burglars, using the slogan of a famous French robber, emptied 250 safe deposit boxes in a Paris bank and took $12 million. They went to a wealthy district and took out of these safe deposits $12 million, and they left slogans on the wall, in quotes, without hate, without arms, without violence, thanks, they wrote on the wall. Now, this happened in Nice, France, in 1976. A man named Albert Spaghieri escaped. He took $10 million out of safe deposits and vaults in Nice. The police had him in their office, and he was caught in 1977, and he, in quotes, escaped. And he said he was using this money for Nazi money to rearm and for the resurgence of Nazis. Now, there is a lot of missing money. If you take $12 million from Paris last weekend and $50 million from the Nugent Hand Bank, and you add up the missing millions. This is going on all over the world, and I began to notice that a couple of years ago, how much money was going into right-wing causes that would be impossible to do without help of the police or the local authorities. And I maybe one of the first things that tuned me into that was the declaration of Albert Spaghieri that he was a Nazi, that it was going for right-wing causes in 1976. So I began a file on missing money, not $2 million or $4 million, but millions of dollars that are floating around the world to fund armies for counterintelligence to put down labor movements or riots if they take place when the going gets tough. There was another case in Switzerland. This was in June 10th this year, where a French bank was missing money. It's the court case of Mr. Pincus and his wife, Florence Pincus. She was living in a hotel in Cannes on the French Riviera. She had divorced her husband, but they were in contact every day. And he had money in the Citibank in New York, the First National Bank in Minneapolis. He had $3.5 million that he took from the Citibank in New York. He had $3.5 million that he took from Minneapolis. And he had even more millions. It was called the Pincus Affair. And he put it in the third largest bank in Switzerland, the Credit Suisse, which was missing millions of dollars several years ago on another case. And all of a sudden, this man took cyanide. According to one portfolio of false documents, he had more than $140 million from various banks. $140 million. He took cyanide, and he talked to his wife on the telephone, his ex-wife down in Cannes, and she took cyanide. And the two of them died just within a short time of each other. He instructed her on how to take her cyanide, so that was $140 million gone from there. $50 million from the Nugenhan Bank in Australia, from noticeably and identified positively with the CIA, $12 million last weekend from Paris, from a safe deposit, leaving notes of thank you. So you begin to add that up, and if you parlay that into weapons and narcotics, roughly that's about $202 million just from three incidences that have happened linked to right-wing causes and so forth. I got a letter from Charles Spears from Texas this last week when I was talking about the Nugenhan affair. He was responding. He's a researcher in Texas, the president of a bank who keeps a chronicle on these affairs and world affairs, past, present, and future. And he wrote to me, "May deductive reasoning, sequence logic, and intuition tell me that the biggest thing you're getting into in 17 years is the millions and even billions of hard right dollars around the world and back again, collected secretly for power, control, action, and terrorism." And he's absolutely of the conclusion that the CIA has hundreds of millions of annual drug trade dollars, that the missing $600 million of the Vatican funds is parlayed into this group, and he mentioned $120 million lost from the Howard Hughes Organization, $45 million from the Franklin National Bank that Michael Sindona took, linked to the Vatican, and the Vatican lost millions and millions of dollars. So when you begin to add this up and you say, where is the money going? It is going to arms and far-right organizations, such as the very extreme group that are behind Ronald Reagan's administration, and the team that have put this group together are using this money and will use it to get their goal specifically, a war against the Soviet Union, their second goal, to turn the entire world Christian. They've already proclaimed that. John Connolly and Leon Jaworski and Gerald Ford, Clint Murchison, the entire Watergate, Nixon, Ford gang down in Texas declared that that is one of their goals, Clement Stone from Chicago, to turn the entire world Christian, and they will take this 50, 60, 100, 200 million and begin radio towers and propaganda and get politicians in until they get their goal. That doesn't leave much leeway for ordinary citizens who may not want to be Christian or happen to be white or black, rather, or minorities, or people who want to improve their lot in life, and the education is getting expensive, and there's no housing, and there's no food, and this money will go into SWAT teams and the Klan and the Nazi organizations to keep them down. It will supply the arms, the paramilitary, to keep the mob quiet as the sources of their income are cut off. There's nowhere to live, and their fuel expenses are high, and the squeeze begins to come down. This money will go into the arms to keep them down. This is the end of the first 30 minutes. I'm going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue with side two or part two of World Watchers.
This concludes the first.